everyone. It's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical billing expert, finding savings can seem impossible. HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. Saving starts with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Raised by his grandmother in Atlanta's Carver Homes housing project, Ricky L. Jones not only became the first member of his immediate family to graduate high school, but by age 28, he also earned a PhD. Currently, he is professor and past chair of the University of Louisville's Department of Pan-African Studies. Jones was educated as an undergraduate at the United States Naval Academy and Morehouse College. He was only the second African-American to receive a PhD in political science from the University of Kentucky, where he specialized in political philosophy and comparative politics. He is a contributing columnist for the Louisville Courier-Journal on the USA Today Network and Baldwin King Scholar-in-Residence, and he is our guest today. This is the Black Information Network Daily Podcast, and I'm your host, Ramses Jha. All right, Ricky L. Jones, welcome to the show, brother. How you doing today?
Oh, brother Ramses, I'm good, man, and I'm happy to sit with the brother with your name because my name is so god awful plain.
Oh man, stop it, man! You got a fantastic name, and it is very marketable, sir. And you know what? I'm excited to get to know you better, and I know that our listeners are excited to get to know you better. And one of the things that we do on this show here is we start our stories at the very beginning. So for those who are uninitiated, do us a favor, give us a little bit about your background, a little bit about your upbringing, and what led you to the career path that you're on today.
Okay. It's something I didn't talk about for a very long time, but I think the story is relevant. And people have told me my mother was impregnated the first time she had sex. So she had me at 15 years old. That's too young to be a mother. I did not meet my father until I was 35. So, you know, I grew up without a father and grew up without a mother who was prepared to be a mother. So my grandmother stepped in to raise me. And my grandmother, who is really the heroine in my life, was born in 1933 in rural Georgia. Never had the chance to attend school. So she passed away in 2009, still virtually illiterate. And so she always told me, you know, look, I don't know what you can do with an education, but I do know what you can't do without one. So, you know, she worked hard. She was a housekeeper in Atlanta, raised me in Carver Homes housing project there in Southwest Atlanta. I eventually was bused to high school in one of the more wealthy areas of the city in Buckhead to Northside High School, then went on to prep school at U.S. Naval Academy prep school in Newport, Rhode Island, and then to the Naval Academy. And once we came to the mutual understanding that I was probably not going to be a very good and compliant Naval officer or Marine Corps officer, I transferred to Morehouse College, which is another story and a great story because that's why I love Morehouse so much. And then, you know, I didn't, and people often ask, you know, how did you know you were going to go to college? Cause nobody else in my family went, you know, it was just something that was there largely because of my grandmother. Some doors opened for me and I took advantage of them as best as I knew how. And, you know, that's the story in a nutshell. I went on to graduate school at the University of Kentucky and have spent my entire scholarly career at the University of Louisville, so, you know, close to home, done some good work, even though we have some serious, serious challenges in the state of Kentucky now. So that's it in a nutshell without boring people.
Oh, no, no, it's not boring at all. It's a fascinating story. So you mentioned that you are a scholar and you have a scholarly career. I want to talk about this note that we have here, you being a Baldwin King scholar in residence. So talk a little bit about that. What is that? What does that encompass? And break it down for us who are uninitiated.
Yeah. That's really, really important to me. Mm-hmm. And the woman who sits at the heart of this, anybody who has drank Woodford, bourbon or Maker's Mark, mm-hmm. Heard of Brown Forman, which is one of the greatest, you know, more wealthy distillers in the country. You've heard of the Brown family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the most influential women in the state of Kentucky is a woman named Christy Brown. And Christy Brown's not only rich, she's one of those rare, wealthy people who has some consciousness about her. Mm-hmm. And I was so disillusioned in the last couple of years with the direction of the University of Louisville that I was looking to get out and try to do something else professionally, really for my own sanity. And the thing that was holding me here and still is I have a teenage daughter who's about to turn 16 in a couple of months. And her mother and I were very committed to not disturbing her life. You know, she has a very good life at a good school, and we're sending her away from Kentucky for college. But the question was, you know, what could we do and how could I survive here mentally and intellectually and socially until I got my daughter out? And so I had a conversation with Christy Brown. I told her what was going on. She actually called me up, and that's another story. And she said, look, you know, don't look to leave right now. Don't look to work remote somewhere. Write up your dream job. Let me know what it is and let's see what we can do. And she has funded a research institute called the Christina Lee Brown Environ Institute. And so the job that I wrote up was a Baldwin King scholar in residence position, you know, an homage to James Baldwin, Martin Luther King Jr., Baldwin, one of my favorite writers.
Sure.
King, of course, my Morehouse brother. And so it's an extension of the work that I do, which I want to be clear is not DEI work. Right. And I'm not saying it's not DEI work for the same reasons that some people are disclaiming DEI, like some universities are running from it. It's not out of fear on my part. But what I see DEI as is really an initiative that lumps everybody who is not white into one category. And in that lumping, you can lose your focus on some things that are very important. So for me, as a Black organic intellectual, a Black intellectual who comes out of the Black experience and is wholly committed to fighting for the fortunes of Black people, I do work on Black people. That's no disrespect to anybody else. Mm-hmm. So that's not necessarily DEI. That's really, really concentrating on the Black experience. And so that's the work that I do with Baldwin King. That's what that's about. And so everything that I do, from scholarly writings to public writings to very consistent radio appearances to programming, all of it is about the continued education of anybody who's curious about the Black experience, one historically, but also what we're facing contemporarily, and then trying to build something more positive for us moving forward in the future. So that's what the Baldwin King Scholar in Residence position is about, and the Baldwin King Project that has come out of that is about. And so I encourage people to check us out.
Well, listen, you came to the right place today, sir.
Yeah, no doubt.
I love how that sounds. You're talking to the right one.
Yeah, no doubt. I can feel it from the name. I told
you. Yeah, man. You came to the right place. Okay. Well, listen, you mentioned a couple of other facets of your career. I think they deserve a proper breakdown as well. So those of us who kind of have a background in radio might be familiar with your work in radio. But, you know, for our listeners who may not be familiar, let's talk about, you know, your career in radio, because I know you spent some time doing that, right?
Yeah. You know, Ramses, all of it is a part of the same thing for me.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So the question for me, you know, coming up in this academic game, and people have to understand only about 2% of the population of the country has PhDs. Only about 5% of the professorate is Black. There just ain't that many of us, despite what a lot of politicians are saying these days, you know, and their quote unquote anti-DEI, anti-CRT moves. And people have to understand these things aren't about critical race theory. These folks don't know what critical race theory is. It's not about DEI. This is really about the maintenance of white supremacy in American education from kindergarten through college. Mm-hmm. That's what they're pushing. Sure. And so you just don't have that many Black professors, you know, at all. And so my role for me as a professor is to train the next generation of Black revolutionary thinkers, whether they be in the professorate, whether they be in politics, whether they be in corporate America, train those thinkers and allies kind of in the tradition of a John Brown, who are not Black, but they're willing to honestly stand with Black people, not in a performative way. But the problem with academia is this: it's such a closed, clannish, elitist profession that a lot of the writing we do goes to these scholarly journals that like 50 people gonna read. And the writing quite often is so dense that nobody can understand it. So the question for me is, even though I had to do that stuff earlier in my career to get tenure, the question is, in the grand scheme of things, what good is it? If you can write the most powerful stuff under the sun, but if nobody's reading it, you know, who cares? Yeah. And so I needed to develop platforms where I could move information faster, right? Because you write an article for a scholarly journal, it's not going to see the light of day for like a year. So I need stuff to move faster. So what I did earlier in my career was to figure out how I could reach people. One way is to write books, but this is an anti-intellectual society. So who's going to sit down and read 150, 200, 250 page book? That's a smaller audience, right? But a larger audience than who's going to read those scholarly journals. That's so right. How could I build out from that? So I started writing on public platforms, first in a local weekly called the Louisville Eccentric Observer. And so I did a monthly column there, which was local. But then I wanted to build a bigger platform. And so I went to the Louisville Courier Journal, which, you know, is kind of a traditionally powerful newspaper, and it joined the USA Today network. Mm-hmm. So I can push stuff out there. You know, people who ain't going to read a 250-page book, maybe they'll read a 750-word column article. And that builds out through USA Today and all these other platforms, Yahoo and whatnot. And I'm constantly looking for places, not for my self-aggrandizement or ego. I'm looking for other platforms where I can write, where more and more people are going to read things that are coming from a Black scholar, but also a project kid who got some different sensibilities. And another way to do that was to do radio. And so I did a radio show through iHeartMedia for a few years. And, you know, it did pretty well. And like you and I have talked about, it's award winning, but winning awards, that's a low bar. But the question is, if I can't get people to read anything, maybe they'll listen. Mm-hmm. But then I just ran out of time. Right. I ran out of time. I wasn't able to do that radio show every week and do all the other stuff. So I had to let something go. Mm-hmm. So I let the Ricky Jones show go. But I do a weekly appearance through iHeartMedia on WHAS on a really well listened to radio show here in the state of Kentucky called the Terry Miner Show. Mm-hmm. So that's the whole thing with radio for me.
Okay. Okay. Fantastic.
The Black Information Network.
I think it's caused us really to focus on the equity and inclusion piece and not just the diversity piece.
Celebrating Black history.
Then.
The die is cast. As I said, we're not asking. We're saying this is the way it's going to be.
And now.
Making sure that, yeah, that was a first, but it won't be the only time that that's happened. We want to make sure that we can continue to do new things.
Because our story continues.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. People don't always realize just how much their negative thoughts and experiences stick with them and weigh them down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mom does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapist anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/BIN today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/BIN.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up! and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
We are here today with speaker, journalist, author, and the Baldwin King Scholar in Residence, the man himself, Ricky L. Jones. You know, there's something special about being in the position that you're in. I, for some time on this show and on my other show, Civic Cypher, which is my bona fide broadcast radio show, we have been eyeing this entity called PragerU, which, for those that are unfamiliar, is basically right-wing indoctrination for K through 12. In other words, the maintenance of the white supremacist institutions, namely the educational institution. And it exists to, it speaks to white adults' sensibilities. And, you know, there's really, again, as I mentioned, far right indoctrination. And so I don't think it can be overstated how important the work that you're doing is, because, you know, there needs to be folks in that same arena who are able to defend teaching American history. You know, these rebrands, they're calling American history CRT. You know, as you mentioned, they're calling, you know, DEI initiatives, you know, and I get what you mean about DEI lumping everything together, but there's a full on attack on it. You know what I mean? And so the idea of, oh, we want to have better trained police, and we don't want diversity programs in employment fields. It's like kind of, you can see the white supremacy in the hypocrisy, right? And so I wanted to make sure that I mentioned that before we move on, that this type of work is exceptionally important. And when I said you came to the right place, I really meant that. This is kind of what I'm on. I've been on this. So, you know, this is a very enjoyable discussion that we're having so far.
Thank you, brother. And I want to be clear, so we have
please.
You know, somewhere to work from. When I talk about white supremacy, mm-hmm. for a very long time, I had a rather naive understanding of white supremacy. I thought the white supremacy was just about, you know, the Ku Klux Klan burning crops on people's lawns, or some white nationalists marching through Charlottesville talking about, you know, you and Jews will not replace us and all that stuff. But that's not what I'm talking about when I talk about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So I told some administrators at the University of Louisville, you know, the plantation where I've labored for 28 years now, that the university is a white supremacist institution. Mm. And people took umbrage. They were like, you know, like, oh, how dare you? I'm like, but all of your predominantly white institutions are pretty much white supremacist institutions when you understand what white supremacy is in America. What white supremacy really is the idea among a good percentage of white folk in the country who think that they and only they have the right to know, think, and decide. Mm. Let me say it again. The day and only day, because of the color of their skin, have the right to know, think, and decide. What do I mean by that? On any important issue, whether it be education, whether it be immigration, whether it be about race, anything, they feel that they have the capacity to know what the real problems are and what they aren't, to think about the proper solutions, and then decide what to do. Mm. And they'll form committees and things of that nature. They might, you know, sprinkle a token black person in on a committee, but they ain't really gonna push back. But at the end of the day, those committees are just advisors. That's it. And the real decision makers have the right to make the final decision. That's white supremacy. Mm-hmm. So when you look at university presidents, you know, like the University of Louisville is a sports factory. They're high revenue sports. The high revenue sports at any school are basketball and football. Who are the students who primarily populate those teams? They're black kids. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, you should always have a black basketball coach. That makes sense to me. You got a predominant majority of black players, but people in Louisville were very excited about getting its first black basketball coach. And I'm like, okay, that's cool. I'm supportive of the brother. Know him. I think he's a good guy, even though they're trying to fire him every freaking day around here. But the question for me is, when you gonna get a black athletic director?
Mm.
Or better than that, when you gonna get a black president at this university? When you gonna get somebody black who the black basketball coach answers to? When you gonna get somebody black who decides whether that black basketball coach is retained or fired? When you gonna get somebody black that decides what are the proper initiatives on race that should be implemented at the University of Louisville or any other school? That's what I'm concerned about. And so what Louisville did and what a lot of these schools do, they took another white president and said, oh, but she's strong on diversity. Well, to hell with that. Give me somebody who looks like me that I can relate to. And I know they're gonna be strong on diversity. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, somebody that's contorted themselves into unrecognized racial ghouls like Tim Scott, you know, or Diamond Still, you know, Candace Owens. Yeah, don't, or Daniel Cameron, who I taught, by the way, you know, and don't get mad at me because Daniel Cameron, the former attorney general who here in Kentucky, didn't listen to a doggone word I said in class, obviously. But that's what I'm talking about when I talk about white supremacy.
Sure.
And the black people that they quite often will put into positions at places like this are so weak and milquetoast, right? They're not going to rock the boat. We're having fundamentally different conversations, brothers like you and me. We're having different conversations as I close on this than people like them, because you'll see them. They tweet about it all. So honored, so grateful to be in this position or this, da 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 da. They're worried about individual, personal positions and have no concept of developing collective black power. Mm. So the conversations are totally different. So I wanted to be clear on what I'm talking about when I talk about, you know, white supremacy and the failure of many black folk, the white folk put into these positions to fight against that white supremacy.
Yeah, I could see, you know, how challenging it is to suggest to otherwise well-meaning, well-intentioned white folks that they are operating a white supremacist construct, framework, institution. Because no one, most folks, I should say, in their heart of hearts, feel like they are a million miles away from it. But I think to your point, it's invisible to so many people. You know, something comes to mind. There was a young man who illustrated a medical textbook, and instead of it being white-skinned anatomical figures, these were black-skinned anatomical figures, right? And see that invisible force and the pushback against that. I mean, these white folks have to pause and be like, oh, that's fair. But, you know, white supremacy positions white folks as the default.
Yes.
When indeed human beings, the default looks like me and you. Right.
Yeah.
Here's another example. My hair is referred to as 4C ethnic hair. instead of hair. And you understand what I mean when I say that, because this is the hair that human beings grow. Everything else is a deviation of that, right? And so white supremacy being the norm, being centered, or whiteness, sorry, being centered and being the norm, that is, out of that is born white supremacist ideas and movements and decisions and so forth. And then inevitably there's blind spots because people, again, in their hearts, they don't feel like they're being, I'm sure whoever came up with 4C hair was thinking they were being inclusive. Yeah, this is the type of hair we should make shampoo for these folks. And by calling it 4C ethnic hair, they are othering indeed what is the natural state of human hair, right? And so I'm saying that to kind of echo your sentiments and to suggest, at least to our listeners, that what you're saying is based in a shared objective reality when you look at a factual basis for it all. So
I appreciate it. You talked about invisibility, mm-hmm. right?
There you go.
And that is what's so crazy about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. It is ever present. I mean, it is omnipresent, but it's simultaneously invisible.
Mm. Especially to them. And the blind spots, that's it. And that's why when you said hiring a black decision maker, it eliminates the propensity for these blind spots to become cancerous, you know, in a long journey of an institution like the one that you called the plantation, and the long story of that, those blind spots become cancerous. And then you have to put together a team to try to fix it as opposed to dealing with it upfront, early and effectively. And at the same time, you're empowering black and brown people to be self-determined. And, you know, that is one of the things that we've been asking for, at least since the Panthers. I know it's certainly a lot further back than that, but I remember it being written down, you know. So kudos to you for that. I do want to make sure that we touch on the books that you've written, because you mentioned them, but I feel like they deserve a little bit more. So, you know, Black Haze, I have here, Obamamania, there's, you know, these books that you've written, you know, just touch on them, you know, briefly before, you know, we get too far away from that.
Yeah, no doubt. Black Haze was my first book. And the subtitle is Violence and Manhood in Black Greek Letter Fraternities. And so what it was an exploration. And I'll trick people. People come in thinking that the book is about fraternities. And I'm a member of Kappa Alpha Psi. But what the book is really about is about manhood construction. And it uses fraternities and hazing as a foil, but that's not really what it was about. And, you know, the scary thing for me was back in the 90s, we saw a spate of deaths, including while I was in graduate school, a young man by the name of Michael Davis was killed out at Southeast Missouri State University by members of my fraternity. He was beaten to death. And so it was really scary. And I got to the point where I was like, you know, why are we doing this, right? And I really, really wanted to explore it. And hope, one, to ameliorate that type of interaction with us, but two, talk about what black fraternities and ostensibly sororities could do and how we were uniquely positioned to speak to some of the socio-political ills that were happening in black America. But we were spending so much time on this scourge of hazing and some other things that it was kind of weakening us. So that's what Black Haze was about. And that book did really, really well, you know, and it was published by the State University of New York Press. And 10 years later, it was the first book in their African-American Studies series that was published as a second edition. So it did well. But I grew really, really frustrated with it, though, Ramsey, because doing work on hazing and talking to black Greeks about it, look, brother, you got just as much chance of going out telling a tree outside of the iHeart Studios where you are to pull up roots and walk as you do with us changing that culture. So I got very frustrated with that work and stepped away from it. My favorite book after that was What's Wrong with Obamamania. Mm-hmm. And so people, that came out in 2008. So it was one of the first books that really explored Barack Obama and what his candidacy and presidency meant to black political imagination. At core, it was a trick too, because people thought it was just about Obama, and by the title, they thought it was some critique of Obama, but it wasn't. It was an exploration, and is an exploration, of Black leadership, you know, and where do we go with Black leadership in the country? So even when we talk about, you know, the subject that we were speaking on a little bit earlier with DEI officers and university officers, or even politicians, right? It's not enough just to have a Black person in a position. You got to have a Black person that has a particular orientation in those positions. Mm-hmm. Because if you put a Black person who is simply a token, who is milquetoast and, you know, going along to get along and is a supporter of the status quo, they can actually be more damaging than helpful. What we didn't talk about, so I loved the Obama Mania book, but one of the criticisms of it was that it was too intellectually dense for a lot of people to get behind it. And I was pissed off, man, because I was like, damn, man, I thought I wrote this book down where people could understand it. So I had to really check myself on the language that I was using in some of my books, because that's kind of a consequence of being in academia for too long. But also during this time, what we didn't talk about, I became the youngest chair in the history of Pan-African Studies, right? And was the youngest chair in the College of Arts and Sciences at the time. So literally 7 years after I took on the professor's position, 35 years old, I became the chair of my department. And that really slowed me down, man, because I was saddled for 15 years. You know, I was the chair of my department for more than half of my career. And so I was dealing with budgets and administrative stuff and fighting people off. And so it slowed some of my long form writing down. And so now I'm able to get back to that. So if people go check out Black Haze, especially check out What's Wrong with Obama Mania, you know, that'd be greatly appreciated.
This concludes part one of our two-part conversation with speaker, journalist, author, and the Baldwin King Scholar in Residence, Ricky L. Jones. Check back in with us tomorrow for part two, where we discuss affirmative action, white supremacy, and the erosion of Black support for Joe Biden, right here on the Black Information Network Daily Podcast.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elia Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
Well, how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.